Good morning, this is Wilma Allen. I'm with the Amelia Island Museum of History, and I'm making a tape this morning with Mr. Lawrence Holmes, who grew up in Fernandina Beach. And we're doing this for the Heritage Keepers Project for the Museum Archives, and it's August 24th. Mr. Holmes, would you like to say good morning?
Good morning.
Could you tell us when you were born and where you were born, and just state where you live now?
I was born March 25th, 1943, in Tampa, Florida. But I've lived here since 45 on 2nd Street in Fernandina Beach.
Okay.
On the waterfront.
On the waterfront. Yeah, you lived up closer to the port on the north side of Second Street.
Right there where they built the port. Uh-huh. Yeah. Right in that location.
Right where they built the
port? Right where they built the port. That was a big, beautiful field, baseball field. Just a wide open space. And baseball was the game of the day there.
Yep. And you, so it was different than the house on Broome Street?
Yeah, there were houses all along 2nd Street. There was a club there that my uncle owned called 440.
Uh-huh.
Now it still sits there. It was called Wicked Davies not too long ago. Now it's a Mexican restaurant, I believe. But it's very old. It's been, it was a high point of the entertainment on 2nd Street for the people who lived on the boats, on the shrimp boats and the pony boats.
Mm-hmm.
It was the place for black entertainment.
In the 40s and the 50s?
In the 50s and on into. I left in the 60s. It all began to change when the shrimp business began to fade. Because at one time, 2nd Street, right off center, we had a Greyhound bus station, Trailways bus station, warehouses, and just all of the businesses right there.
On the north side.
On the north side, yeah. On like Center Street, that was the downtown commerce.
Mm-hmm.
The grocery markets and businesses and jewelry, hardware, all of the business was there. Of course, now this was during the Jim Crow era, so there was limited access to those areas for black people. And most of the people who came in here on those boats lived on the boats. You know, there were no hotels or rooming houses. The only really prolific hotel was the Keystone Hotel, which for some reason they tore it down, but it was magnificent. It was a big, beautiful set. Right at the corner of 8th and Atlantic. There's a bank on that spot now.
Mm-hmm.
But if that hotel were still here, it would be high point for the city.
Yeah, I've read that people, after that hotel was torn down, people started thinking, hey, wait a minute, let's try to hold on to what's left. And that started a lot of people getting interested in preservation and that kind of thing. Now, when you were growing up, you were a little boy, and you lived on 2nd Street.
Yes.
And you went to Peck High School? Or you went to elementary
Catholic
school first? You went to the Catholic school.
Yeah, that was, you know, we had two Catholic schools. And the one I went to was right down the street from St. Michael's.
Mm-hmm.
It was called St. Peter Claver.
Oh, I didn't realize that was a school. I thought that was
the
church.
It was the black Catholic school.
Oh.
And then, because we didn't go to school together. But I went to school there until sixth grade, and then I went to Peck, beginning from sixth grade until graduation.
Was there another school you could have gone to other than that one? Like a public school?
Only Peck was the public school. And Peck was the school for all of the black people in the Nassau County. From Hilliard, from Yulee. They had a couple of, in Yulee you can go up to seventh grade and then you had to come to Peck.
Did Peck have little, like, third grade, fourth grade too?
Yeah, Peck went from first grade to 12th grade.
Okay.
And there was an advantage to that because you had the same teachers, they got to know you, and they all lived in the same community with you, so there was zero tolerance for failure. You could not fail. If you missed any subject, even in physical education or art or any subject, you had to repeat the entire year. So it was like a private school in that sense. And they gave you homework and assignments. You came out of there, you learned to read, to write, to multiply, divide. And those things were the basic skills that you needed to live. When we got new books, when the white school discarded their books, they came to us. When their buses were old, we got the buses. You know, it was like that. But I think our advantage was having that kind of a system to come up in. And if you failed the school, it went home. Your parents knew before you got home. So there was a strict discipline. I think the worst thing anybody might do was smoke a cigarette in the bathroom or something. But it was just a great... Now that looking at it and having lived all in other cities and seeing how things work, it was a magnificent school.
That's what I've heard from everybody.
And many people who left here, because most of us, our parents raised us not to stay here and work on boats or in the mills or do menial work. They raised us to get out of here and go to other places where you had relatives and start over again, you know.
Did it work out for a lot of people?
It worked out for many people. Mm-hmm. And even the people who stayed here did pretty well with having the basics, reading and writing and understanding, because I found out in the cities, your job application was your test. You go to a place, apply for a job, they would give you the application, and you had to sit there and fill it in. If you could read and understand, if you could provide the right information, 3 references, name, address, phone number, if you could make a complete application, you could get a job. And we were not afraid of work. I mean, everyone worked here in this town. Everybody worked. It was there was no fear of working. When we got to the city, they were always looking for us country boys from the south
because we worked.
Huh. And so many people became plant managers and middle managers. And many people went on to school and got college degrees and did well.
Well, let's go back to your beginnings. Your folks, you were born in Tampa. Did your folks live in Tampa? What brought them to here?
Well, my mother had a sister here. They lived on the waterfront. And my uncle, who was married to my mother's sister, he owned a shrimp boat. And they owned that club I was talking about, 440. So in those days, you had to have your own businesses because the white establishment didn't do business with black people. I mean, you could go in the stores and buy stuff, but you couldn't go and sit at a counter or you couldn't spend more time there than just to go and make your purchases and leave. And so it was necessary for us to have our own businesses, and we have many, many black businesses.
Did the whites come to them?
Oh, no. That was the whole point of the Jim Crow laws, you know, that we would be separate in every way. They called it, but equal, but of course, that was never equal in any way. My mother and my stepfather, they owned and operated the only black dry cleaning business that's ever been in Ferndale. It's called the Deluxe Dry Cleaners. And they did a lot of business because black folks went to church and black folks dressed a lot. And the white laundries and cleaners would not clean black people's clothes. And so they had a thriving business until integration. When they began to break down the barriers of integration, and all of the white establishments started to take in business from black folk, we couldn't survive. Plus, my oldest brother, who was a key part of the business, he graduated and went on the way to the army, and it was things just began to change.
So why did the black folks that used to like the deluxe dry cleaner then go to the white dry cleaner?
Now that is a mystery. But that's what happened.
Maybe they offered lower rates or something like that.
I guess it was a mindset because that integration did not change. The mindset, the system was the same. You know, if you there was a time, for instance, that a woman could not own anything.
Yeah, I remember that.
A woman couldn't have a house or a car. It had to be in a man's name.
Yeah, I remember that. Even with savings account or something.
No matter what it was, you had to have a man's name attached to it. And it proved that women were better business people as far as how to track the money and how to pay the bills and all those things. Because men would go out and earn the money, bring it home, say, here's the house expense money. And then Papa went on about his business. But the ladies, and my mother and all the women I knew, they took care of all of the household functions. Disbursement of funds and bills and insurance and all those things. And it was just a system. It was just the system. And as time went on, some of that changed. In our community, though, it was still pretty much, this is the black side of town, this is the other side of town. The area called the Main Beach, we could only be in that area of town if we were there working. And then after, say, 6 in the afternoon, you could not be in that area unless you were working. You know, you couldn't be walking on the streets up on Fletcher and all those places. It was, this was a little out of paradise, only we didn't know it then. I mean, things grew here. There were fruits and vegetables, and there were things everywhere, berries. It was a great place for kids to grow up. We had all the fresh seafood in the world.
But you had restrictions as to where you could go.
Yes. Even though, like the lady you were just telling me about, we could have been neighbors, but we couldn't have been friends. Mm-hmm. We could have known each other.
Well, like she said that her mother said, oh, you shouldn't go down on 2nd Street.
Now,
could you go on 3rd Street?
But you could go through 3rd Street. You could, but it wasn't a place where you could just sort of hang out, even though it was just a block or half block from where you lived. But the laws were just that strict. And
you probably didn't feel welcome.
Oh, no, because every now and then they would have a Klan march just to intimidate the community, the black community. I worked in a barber shop on Center Street, right next to Mayor Middleton's hardware store. And the jewelry store, Griffin Jewelry and Middleton, and there's the barbershop. And so all of the people would come in and shoot, get their shoes shined. And I knew all of the men who came in the barbershop because I shined their shoes. And then one night, there was a Klan march right down 2nd Street. They had the hoods, the robes, the whole thing. And I'm standing there with my mother and my parents and everybody, and we're watching this. And I'm looking at their feet, and I say, I know that. I could tell every guy who was in that march, and they were the elite people, the people who ran the city, but.
So did you go and shine your shoes again and not say
anything? I'm 8, 9 years old, but I understood the significance of it. And when I shouted out, I said, that's the police right there. I shine his shoes all the time. And my aunt clapped me shut. I said, just be quiet.
So you watched as they walked by in their intimidating outfits. Just to scare you, but they didn't do anything.
It was just like the whole idea of the Jim Crow laws, which is a big thing today in the news and all the statues and all of those things. Those were monuments and statues that were put in place to say, okay, the slavery part is over. But these are to let you know who's in charge, who runs this. And so they built all these monuments to people who actually declared war on the United States. The southern states broke away from the United States and declared war against them. And so they were seditionists. But then they built all these memorials to keep it alive, and that war just never ended.
Yeah.
And even now, it's not ended.
Yeah, that's for sure.
So it's time now to end that, and just because people have gotten together, whether you like it or not, people from all races, religions, creeds, and colors have gotten together, and the world is changing. The people are changing. But I watched it. I grew up with it. And it existed in the cities. Every city had its black neighborhoods, wherever the poor people were, that's where all the crime was, that's where all the drugs were, so it was just practiced a different kind of way in the cities.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to what we dealt with down here in the South.
So you went to Peck High School, and you thought it was a great education.
And I left there. I graduated in 1961.
Graduated Peck. And where did you go after that?
I went to D.C., and I began working, and I got drafted. had to come back and go in the military.
So tell me, when you went to D.C. and you were working, what kind of work were you doing? Did you just go up there and hope to find a job?
No, my oldest brother had established, he was a maitre d' in a country club. He's like, he was the head waiter. He assigned, he had hiring authority. He hired bartenders and waiters. It was a good living. It was lots of money. I mean, you made cash every day as a waiter or a bartender. But it was just so, the hours were just ridiculous. You just had to work and work. And I was working at that. And after I got drafted, and when I went back to D.C., I went to work in the transit system in
1967. So you went back to D.C. after the service. You were drafted into the Army. Did
mm-hmm,
you have to go overseas and fight in Vietnam or something?
I just went on temporary things. I was never assigned permanently to an overseas base.
Uh-huh.
But I was in the type of unit that we went TDY to different places.
TDY, what does that mean?
Temporary duty.
Oh, I see.
It's like we would go into Mexico to White Sands where they fired missiles. I was attached to an artillery unit, but I was in communications.
Uh-huh.
And as a radio operator, radio teletype operator, whenever the field units went out, You had to go into the field with them. So I spent a lot of time in tents and pup tents and sleeping in sleeping bags.
So you did that for a couple of years?
Yeah, and then I had a full 6-year commitment with active duty and reserve duty. But I think it was some of the best years, you know, because it gave you a chance to travel and see things and go to places. And I learned to be unafraid going to places I'd never been before. And where I didn't know anyone. But it was a lot more kind of friendly atmosphere in the cities then. There were jobs in the cities. They hadn't been quite great yet and all the work left the cities, the factories
which
closed,
cities?
All of the cities, Detroit, Chicago, and all of the inner cities, Philadelphia, the work began to go farther and farther away from the cities, and that left the cities inhabited by mostly black people. And that's when they began to have black mayors. When the cities were shot. And a lot of those mayors brought those cities back, brought them back up. The Chicago mayor, we had a mayor in D.C., his name was Walter Washington. He was the first mayor, but he wasn't elected. He was an appointed mayor. But things began to change in the cities. And if you look at it, all the way to New York and L.A., they all began to have black mayors. And those cities.
Well, we had Charles Albert, too, here.
Yeah, here, that's right. That's
but
right.
You didn't live here at that time.
No,
you were still in D.C.
But I knew Mr. Albert as a teacher. He had been one of the teachers here.
Was
very
he your
smart
teacher?
Man. Brilliant man.
Was he your teacher?
I don't know if I took any classes directly from Mr. Albert, but there was more than just him. He had a couple of brothers who were school teachers.
Oh, really?
Well, yeah. And it was
did you come back here to visit family during those years?
I did, but I stayed away from here after 61. It took me about 6 or 7 years to come back.
Uh-huh.
because I thought this was a terrible place. But I found out there were a lot more terrible places than this one. Mm-hmm.
So when you were growing up, you told me about the baseball players and the fact that they didn't stay at the Keystone Hotel with the black players, had to stay in people's homes,
right,
because the Keystone Hotel was separated.
They were not allowed, the black players, to stay there. So when they began to bring, I think the Washington, D.C. was the first farm club that actually came to Fernandina. Mm-hmm. Now, all of the major league teams would come to Florida for spring training, Bradenton and other cities, and someone discovered Fernandina. And when they brought the players here, it was the first time that I had ever seen people who looked just like me, people from Cuba, Santo Domingo, from all over Nicaragua, and they spoke no English. And in fact, the Spanish they spoke was different. They didn't always understand each other's Spanish. And they lived with us. They ate with us. They found homes that could rent rooms, mm-hmm, to these players. And that was the way the system worked.
And that was in the 50s and the...
That was in the...
probably the 60s, too.
60s, yeah. Yeah, because I left at 61 and it was going on then. But it had begun in like the late 50s, 58 maybe, 57, 59, in those years. And those teams eventually, I don't know how long they stayed here, but they took that big, beautiful field and built the port down. And it destroyed the historic district of Fernandina. If they had not put that port right where they put it, they would have a beautiful historic district.
And that was where the baseball field was that these teams practiced. So where did they practice, I wonder, after that?
It sort of killed the semi-pro thing. They used to have teams that would come here from Georgia, Jacksonville, every Sunday. And they would have baseball games on that field. And the whole community would come down on 2nd Street. And there would be like picnics, you know. It would be roasting, doing ribs on the grills. And
was it blacks and whites?
Well, whites were always free to come if they wanted, uh-huh, to. But it was primarily black teams, black people.
Mm, that's probably why it didn't last.
yeah. But it was a good era, you know. The competition was good, and it was a great day on Sundays, all day. You know, there would be ball games, and you could look across that field. You could look across at Goat Island. You could see how plush and luxurious it was. Now, the place where they built the port, they could have built it out where the Pogie plant existed, or they could have moved it right on up past downtown out to where they used to run a gambling boat used to dock. Mm-hmm. And that would not have destroyed the historic district. Like now, our historic district got that big industrial thing there, and they can't expand it. They can't expand downtown. They can't, and they let the waterfront just go dead. Mm. The docks used to have boats parked all the way. Sometimes the boats would be 2 and 3 deep because people came here from everywhere to fish. There would be boats here from Texas and Louisiana and Mexico, everywhere. And the boats here, during certain times of year, they would travel to Campeche and to all over the world. And I never could understand this. I used to go on the boat with my uncle. In those days, they didn't have computers and all of that. They had a compass and they had a sextant, and they traveled. They could go anywhere by water. And I remember one day I was riding on a boat with my uncle, and he said, "Well, we just crossed into Georgia water." Now, all I saw was water. I mean, there were no road maps or lines. But they could go anywhere. And there were two men on a shrimp boat. If anything happened, if the boat broke down, the engine malfunctioned, they out there in the middle of the ocean, they had to repair it. They had to do something about it. And they did. That's why it was such an adventurous life. And it was amazing. The things that they could do on those boats. They could parallel park those boats like you do a car.
Yeah.
They could parallel park it, then another boat would park right beside it and tie off on it. And you would jump from one boat to the next, because there would be that many.
Wow. So those boats were probably about the same size as the couple of shrimp boats they have now?
Shrimp boats, yeah. Some of them were a little bigger. The pulley boats now, those were 27-man crews. They were huge boats.
Huh.
And they had like 27, 30 men living on each boat. And on those boats, they did not have closets. They did not have toilets. And you couldn't stock or store a lot of stuff. And I'm talking about men who were making big money. They were making great money. Even back in the 50s, they would get out with 300, 200, depending on how much they caught.
Wow.
And it was big for business. The stores downtown would thrive when the boats came in and those guys were paid. And the first thing you want to do when you get paid is have some fun. So we had the American Beach. That was a great place to be. And what they did, They made the American Beach miles out of town, way back there where it is. And then the White Beach, the main beach, they built it too close to the ocean. When they started building the houses, if they had built it on the opposite side of Fletcher, they would have a lot more beach.
Mm.
Instead, they built on the side of Fletcher closest to the water. And it has caused those homes and
hurricanes
and flooding and all of that. But if they had only started on the other side, man, they would have a beautiful beach, like Jack's Beach, with all that wide open space.
Yeah. Now you were gone for a while and you came back, so that will give you an interesting thing you can talk about growing up here. But then what was it like? How did you think when you came back to live here? When was that?
In 2000.
Came back in 2000. And what brought you back?
Well, life in the city had gotten to be not only dangerous, but real expensive. And by now, you know, we're moving toward retirement incomes.
Mm-hmm.
And I found it far easier financially. I was able to buy a nice home here, my wife and I. She retired from the federal government at an early age. So things had changed an awful lot.
Your wife?
No longer.
What is her name?
Her name is Constance.
Constance. And
she
worked for the federal government. You met her up in D.C.,
I met her in D.C.
Do you have children, too?
We have two sons. And they are both grown and gone. So it's just us.
But they grew up in D.C., so
they
probably had
different... And they still live in D.C. They come down every once in a while, but it's too quiet here. You know, it's too,
yeah.
I have a lot of friends who come here, and all they do is sleep when they get here. I guess that city is wearing them out.
It's supposed to be a vacation, right?
They get down here, all they want to do is sleep.
So when you came down, what did you think of all the way it had changed?
Not a whole lot had changed. It looked pretty much the same.
Mm-hmm.
Center Street was Center Street. The difference was they had built the businesses out in the area of
Saddle Road
and downtown had become the tourists. No businesses, just tourist things. Few restaurants and little shops. But there's not even a grocery store down there. It's just that. So it had divided the island in that way. And everyone living here, you had to come out in the Saddle Road area to do your shopping and whatever malls were out there, the Walmarts and different things. And none of that was down in the historic district. The historic district had become important for tourism. And they restored a lot of those old houses and people went on walking tours and whatever. But they didn't really... There's always a serious problem with what to do with a car down there.
Mm.
Like right now, you go down there, you might find somewhere to park or you might not. But that is still a major problem, especially since they started the festivals. And they put all these thousands of people in that one little area from the waterfront back up to about Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, back up.
Well, you
to about
Eighth
Street.
And sometimes they, for the shrimp festival, they even have Central Park for children.
Yeah,
so
it seems that I think they should spread out the festival all the way out to the main beach. They should have events and things. So you don't crowd all these people into that one little area downtown. But that's what they do each year.
Now your family, you told me, still has property on Second Street.
Yeah, Second Street. I think we're probably the last black family down there. But it used to all be black. Everyone lived down there because of it was near the boats. Those boats would come in and they would put out their signals that they had shrimp to head and people to go and work down there. And it was the smell of this town. The more you live near the docks, the more the boat smell and the fish. And they had a plant out there they called a pogie plant where they processed the fish to make different products. And when they were cooking those fish, this whole island smelled like a cesspool. I don't know, I think they stopped doing that part of it. But all over this island was terrible. It was just terrible. Especially with people who live near that plant. Because when they were cooking up that stuff, boy, it was a hard life. But most people didn't want to live down near that waterfront just because of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can imagine. And then the paper mills made a lot of stink.
They made a lot, yeah. And then they used to dump everything into the water. You know, acids and stuff they burned off of those mills. It all went right into the river, which helped to pollute and screw it up.
Yeah, so then it was probably... Efforts were underway to clean up environmentally, to clean up pollutants and all, keep them out of the water.
But it was just so crazy living under the Jim Crow era.
Mm-hmm.
because everything, the hospitals, the emergency care, if you got hit by a car, the white ambulance will not pick you off the street and take you to the hospital. And when they first began to hire black police officers, they could not arrest white people. They could only arrest black people. It did not matter what they saw, what crime they saw you commit, they would have to call a white police officer. You know, that's how crazy that is.
It didn't work the other way. White police officers could arrest anybody they
wanted. They could arrest anybody. They could shoot anybody. They could do anything. You know, it was just... If you wanted to beat your family and beat up your wife, you paid $10 for disturbing the peace. It was really not a crime, you know. Men were the dominant ones, and they could be the judge, the police, anybody. It was just cruel. It was really cruel the way it was.
So you're speaking of not just Fernandina Beach area, but everywhere.
Everywhere. Yeah.
But it happened here too.
Yeah, and that's still a big problem in our society now. You know, battering women and children. And then some men still have that in their psyche. But it's it came all during that era, when man was all power. You know, you could. And it was like the white man that you worked for was the way you got credit. The way you, if you worked for Captain So-and-so, then you got in trouble. They would call him. If you worked at the hardware store or whatever business you worked for, that was the way you were able to establish yourself and buy what you needed for your family. I had a couple of friends in school with me. Them and their father were boat builders. They could draw the design for a boat. Then they could build it. They worked for the Tuliakas Boat Company.
Oh yeah, boat builders.
They built all the boats that Tuliakas sold. These boys, they were drummers. Frank Drummond, Robert Drummond.
Betty Wilson.
Yeah.
She told me about the front of the boats that were beautiful, that were made from... Yeah, that must have been her...
They were great boat builders. Mm-hmm. And they were brilliant mathematicians. They were... I mean, these guys could do it all. But and then, you know, we had carpenters. We had men with skills. But, you know, it was hard for them to get a license and become contractors and that, because the laws didn't allow that. They had to work their skills for somebody else. But they still. I had another friend. His father, him and his father, built a house from the ground up. I mean, they did it all. They laid the house, poured the foundation, and they did a lot of work in the community. You know, home repairs and remodeling and all that. But I don't know if they ever became licensed contractors.
So now you are retired, but you still play in your musical group, the Instant Group.
Yes.
And you've been doing that for... Did you always play music?
I did. As a child, we played music here. And I did music in D.C. And... along with the other kinds of jobs, I was always doing some kind of music. And when we were in high school, I remember, my brother and I had a band. And the white kids wanted us to play for a dance for them. Mm-hmm. And my mother said, no, I don't think you should go out there and do that live. But the police came, and they said, we'll pick them up, we'll take them out and let them play this dance, and we'll bring them back home. And that's the only way that we got permission to do it. It was, you know, it was a great dance. Everybody had a ball. But it was just those times, you know, you couldn't, you and I could not have sit and talk like this. You know, we couldn't have been able in the same car, in the same area, you know. But
what kind of music did you play? Obviously, rock and roll stuff.
Yeah, that's the stuff of the day back in the 50s, whatever it was.
Mm-hmm. That's really cool.
But I remember that particular incident. And I remember how nervous my mother was about it. She did not want us to do it. But after the police came and assured our safety that they wouldn't let nobody drag us off into the night.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, that's amazing to think that the world was like that, where the world was. Anyway.
You know what our parents had to do? Because so many black men would go off to fish, go to Louisiana. It was so dangerous until they found step parents. I mean, godparents. We all had godparents, and the godparent did not have to love you, but if he stood in church and became your godparent, if something happened to my mother, father, they would see to it that you went to school. They would see to it that you were fed. They would do all they could to keep you out of trouble. And that's what the godparents were very serious about, all of this thing. There was another protection that people used to look out for their children. You would find some friends who would be the godparents for your children. And that was stronger than government programs or anything to ensure your safety if something happened to your guardians or your parents. If you had a grandmother or somebody, then you might be all right, but my godmother is still alive today, and all of our lives we grew up with that extra set of parents.
That's Mabel.
Yeah,
that's right.
She's still my godmother.
Yeah. Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful.
It was just good to have that kind of person to turn to.
Do they still do that?
I don't hear much about it now.
I don't either.
No, but it was for real. It was a serious program. If you went and asked someone, I want you to be the godparents for my children.
That's a huge.
They didn't just say, okay, just and let it go. They were seriously your godparents. Mm-hmm. And we were policed by the whole community. Any adult who saw you doing something wrong, they would chastise you about it. And then they would go tell your parents.
Yeah. So, now you had a brother. Did you have any other brothers? You had an older brother?
I had two brothers. And then my sister came along 5 years later. She was the youngest of us. And there were four of us. I had two older brothers and a younger sister. And you know,
do they live around, or did they all move away too?
They're all gone. My sister, the youngest one, she died first.
Oh.
And I'm the last of that group of Mohicans. But it was like everybody eventually left. He grew up, got out of school, and
that's what I was going to ask you about. I got this. Saw the newspaper the other day. And it had an article about population shift in Fernandina Beach.
Mm-hmm.
And it showed And I didn't verify this, I just saw it in the paper, but it shows that between changes between 2000 and 2010. So you came back to Fernandina in 2000. And here's the population change, and it's listed by race. And it looks like black or African American alone decreased by, 18%, but all the other groups increased.
Yeah, because what happened is that when most of us left and moved to the cities, and we left our old parents and the people here, they left property, and many people never came back to live here and live in that property and take it over and pay the taxes on it. A lot of people would come back and someone left them a home. They sold it and went back to the cities. And I think that's probably the biggest shift. That's one of the reasons, because that happens even now. We lose the properties that were left to you by the old people just for not paying the taxes and not doing what it takes to inherit. Probating, things like that. So the system found ways to take that property.
So does your family still live, somebody in your family still live in your house?
Yes. Because on Broome Street, yes, sir.
But they probably get offers, people to buy it.
Well, it's in the historic district, so it's under the laws of the historic district. Mm-hmm. And for the house next door to us, which is just now occupied, that house had been vacant for 30 years, 20 years or so. And because of that, they had to go through a whole lot of zone fighting when a man recently bought it and put the renovation into it. They still couldn't get, it wasn't zoned for them to live in. They couldn't tear it down because it's in a historic district.
Gosh, how confusing.
Because it's in a historic district, you had to refurbish it, but you couldn't just tear it down and start over again.
But you couldn't live in it either.
You couldn't live in it either because of the industrial residential.
Are they
zone.
Living in it now, do you know?
Yeah, they are living in it. That's all that's there. From the corner of 2nd and Broome Street, we have a vacant lot, and then there's the Erickson, and then there's our house. So we exist on both sides of Mr. Erickson's house. But the house that our, my family's home is like well over 100 years old. It's maybe 110 or more.
So you were saying 2nd Street, but where your uncle's restaurant was, if you had continued on that, it would have been houses for a couple of blocks out that way?
There were houses all the way up 2nd Street, all the way until, what's the name of that, to where the port ends going out. It was, there were people living all along the waterfront and on 2nd Street. And even though 2nd Street was a business district, it was also residential because there were so many people who lived there.
So that was passed, I think that Dade Street is where all the trucks go, so it would have been even past Dade Street.
Yeah, it would. Yeah. Up to Dade Street, where you come in to customs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and all of those, there were people, black people, living all along there. And eventually, everyone was gone. And now there's only us.
Yeah. You don't see, when you walk around downtown, you don't see too many black people enjoying Center Street and working in the stores.
The local people don't come down there. I think if you see black folks, they're usually tourists or they're from Georgia or someplace. They'll come down and enjoy the tourism downtown, but it's not. And then the fact that they built so much on the other side of the bridge.
Yeah.
From O'Neill on back, they built and built and built until they built a box out there. Because if you live in those communities off of A1A, and you got to come back to A1A to get anywhere in and out, it's difficult. It's difficult. And they're trying to expand on A1A now, but it's beginning to look more like Blanding Boulevard.
Oh, God, I know. I live right near there.
And coming in and out of there is very difficult because you've got to come back to A1A.
Yeah. So do you think that this will ever change much, that this configuration of people?
There are not many young people who are going to come and live here because this town took away everything that made young people want to be here. For instance, when I started coming back here on vacation, they used to have a skating rink, there was a bowling alley, there was a theater, there was a water slide up on the beach. There were several things up there to entertain children. There were basketball courts. So you had lights you could put a quarter and get lights and play ball at night. There were just things that were... Eventually, there was a bunk car thing. Things where you could bring children here and entertain them. And eventually, they just got rid of all of that. There's nothing here now for a child. If you bring a kid here for vacation, you have to take them to Jacksonville, to Waterworld, or take them someplace else for entertainment because they have a skateboard park and they have that little park for little children like that. But there's nothing here to interest a teenager or children, and they deliberately took all those things out. I don't know why they did that, because all they want to do here now is have a residential with some hotels along the beach and
cater to the
and
older
the high
people.
School, yeah, and our high school, the population is dwindling for our high school, Fernandina High. Yeah, Fernandina High is going to be like a charter school sooner or later. Because now, that used to be the only
school in the county. And people used to come from Hilliard.
To these schools in Fernandina. Now you got, three high schools out in...
Yeah, in Yulee area.
Yeah, in Nassau County. So the one here... It's not. They don't have the population that they used to have.
Like it says on this, with regard to the ages, you can see the ages of the people are so much. Most of the people are my age.
And they want quiet.
I do. We don't want loud music.
That's right. Or teenagers running around in dune buggies. They sure did make it happen.
Well, maybe too, though. I mean, I don't know, but it seems like so many kids are so involved with their computers now that maybe they don't... Maybe a lot of places don't have things for teenagers much anymore.
Yeah, but you got to have... you got to have young people.
Yeah.
And,
they got to have some outlets for their energy.
Have some outlets for young people.
Well, we're almost out of time. Is there anything that you want to say that I didn't ask you about, or you want to add to?
Well,
about considering that this is for the museum, for the history, something that should be remembered.
I think that there's a, I know there's a small section here about the fishing and shrimping industries, but it used to be so much a part of the black life in Ferndale. If a black man became the captain on a shrimp boat or the captain on a pogie boat, that was a very high position, a well-paying type of position, real responsible kind of job. And we had some of them that were never really recognized. I think Neil Frank, his father, was one of the first captains on a pogie boat.
Yep.
And he was a very well-known and revered man, because he was a brilliant man. And there were maybe one or two other black guys who were captains on those pogie boats. And there were very few who could own one. Later years after I had gone, I found that some of the guys I went to school with had become captains on shrimp boats. And those were big positions still, long into the 60s. And
did they own the boats, or they were captains on boats that somebody else owned, or feeders?
It was both ways.
Both ways.
Some of them were captain for other owners, and there were a couple of guys who owned their own boats. But that was really a big time kind of work, and I think a little more attention should be paid to what happened to the shrimp industry in Ferndale. When they began that shrimp festival, it used to be about the boats. They used to actually have the shrimp boats race, and people would come from everywhere. And for some reason, they let the docks just become impassable. You know, our waterfront is, we got Brett's, yeah. And that's it.
Yeah, that's a shame.
And all of the rest of that waterfront is blighted. And no one's done anything about it to make it into a...
Talk about it.
Yeah, that's all they talk about. Mm-hmm. And they do surveys, studies. They hire some college to do a report on it, but then they never do anything about it. And you look at all the other cities like Jacksonville, Landing, and all the cities have a waterfront that's a developed place where you can
do things, enjoy it.
Not here. That could be the highlight. That's the most expensive land in front of Dana, down there by the docks. But,
Well.
I'm told they're getting ready to build some $400,000 townhouses.
Yes, where the, the ones I'm knowing, there may be more, but the ones where the lumber yard was,
right.
It's going to be fancy townhouses.
But where are they going to park?
I think they have plans to have the lower level be parking for the people that live there, but you're right, they're just going to bring more and more people.
If you have a guest there coming, they're going to have to park inside your house.
Yeah.
Anyway, that one thing, and the real history of our fishing industry, because I guess I kind of grew up with the...
Have you been in the what they call the Shrimping Museum?
Go in and look around.
It's right down by the Atlantic Seafood area. Go in there, because that's in a recent...
This is separate.
Yeah, it's separate. But it's kind of this museum, I think, operates that shrimping museum section.
Go look at that.
I'm
how
sure
much
you,
of it they preserve.
Yeah, and you probably have some. And also Gray, who's here? Gray Edenfield. He's a curator here at the museum. He wrote a book that came out recently about the shrimping industry here. So he did a whole lot of research.
It was amazing, because you could... At one time, you could get a boat from here to New York, you could catch a bus from right here and go anywhere. Greyhounds and trailways.
Not anymore.
And they cut all of that off. They cut it all out. It's crazy.
Well, on your way downstairs, there's a little gift shop, and you might see Gray's book about the shrimping and Fernandina in there. Take a look at it.
I'll do that.
Okay, well, now, here it is, 10:30, we're still on tape, and I'm going to say so long to Lawrence Holmes. It was a pleasure to speak
yes,
with you.
Yes, ma'am, it certainly was. Thank you.
Thank you.
Opportunity.
Thank you, and we'll send you, enable you to get a copy of this